Hi, everybody. My name is Eric Schatzker. I'm an editor at large here in New York City. Welcome to Bloomberg The Year Ahead. You'll see somebody else on the screen right now. That's David McCormick. For those of you who don't know David, I'd like to give you a taste of his extraordinary resume. He's a West Point graduate, a Princeton PhD. He served as an officer in the first Gulf War, and he was an undersecretary in the second George W. Bush administration. Today, of course, he's the CEO of Bridgewater Associates. David, it's great to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you for joining us. David, here's where I'd like to begin. You're a Republican. You served in government. You even considered taking a job in the Trump administration. I'd like to know, how does the country move forward from what happened at the Capitol building on January 6th from your perspective?
Well, it's something I think we've all been thinking about. And, you know, you have to start with the recognition that what we saw at the Capitol was just horrific and will be a dark chapter in American history and something that hopefully will wake us all up to the need for being able to bring our disagreements together and find unity and agreement. And I think it just puts the, you know, a highlight on the responsibility of leaders to be able to create a dialogue where people are understood, people with a variety of frustrations and concerns and anxieties can come together and find a common purpose for the country. So I hope it'll be one of those things which brings not just Republicans, but Republicans and Democrats back to the table in terms of thinking, you know, the appropriate direction for the country. And I think it's important to remember that coming out of the election, that the, you know, the break and the division was very evident in the support that President Trump or former President Trump received in the election. So it's a real challenge and a real opportunity, I think, to bring the country together.
I mentioned, David, that you're a Republican, at least you have been. How would you like to see the party move forward?
Well, I know it's it sounds trite, but I think this notion of being able to you know, use our disagreements as a way to come together and listen and understand one another is really critical. And the thing that that Donald Trump did was tap into a reservoir of, you know, I'm a kid from Scranton, outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania. I served in the Army. What he tapped into was a reservoir of people, you know, many tens of millions of people who have lost faith in government, have lost faith in the system, feel like the American dream is no longer available to them, feel like the opportunity that once defined America no longer exists. And so we need to appeal to that group of people, again, we as a country, and bring them back into the system. And I think the Republican Party needs to find a way to do that, to recognize the you know, that frustration, but channel it. Channeled in a way that's productive and constructive, and that's going to require, you know, bipartisanship. It's going to require a common purpose. So I hope the Republican Party will take that energy and channel it in a way that'll be productive, not only for the people that are most affected, but also for the country at large.
Does that, in your mind, mean jettisoning Trumpism or embracing it?
Well, I'd say that it's extremely important to recognize that President Trump tapped into that level of frustration, anxiety. You cannot wave your hands and that goes away. That's very meaningful, and those frustrations and anxieties remain unaddressed. So embracing that and the feeling that that sector of our country needs to be well understood and brought into the fold is a thing I think we have to embrace going forward. I think what we have to not embrace is the divisiveness that's characterized, you know, the last 4 years and the polarization. And I think the president has some responsibility, a lot of responsibility for that. And I think that, you know, this last dark chapter on the Capitol will be, history will look very unfavorably on that and all that, all the people that were involved in that.
Share with me, David, your thoughts on what you've seen and heard from the Biden administration so far.
Well, it's early days, and you know, I really appreciated President Biden's tone in terms of his responsibility to serve the whole country, and bring together that common purpose. And now we'll see how that agenda plays out over time. I think he's picked a number of very capable people for key positions, which is encouraging. But there's a real moment here and a real challenge, and he steps into, you know, an economic crisis, a health crisis, challenges in America's role in the world. And I hope that he'll use this moment to really do two things: to address some of the underlying problems that existed before the pandemic hit. And by that, I mean opportunity, equality, and some of the challenges that we face in the country that's really leading to the polarization, the challenges with the rise of China and putting together a holistic strategy for addressing that and America's role in the world. And so there's an opportunity to reset and really address those problems in a very meaningful way. And I hope that the tone that President Biden has used around bipartisanship will really play out in how he addresses those problems. And that means that, you know, he's going to have his own challenges within his party, just like Republicans have their challenges within within the Republican Party. And I think it's really critical that he live up to the tone that he set. And I'm hopeful that he will. It's too early to tell how that'll manifest itself.
David, you shaped economic policy as an undersecretary, both at the Treasury and the Commerce Department. If you were in government now, what policies would you be advocating most strongly?
Well, I think there's a set of responses to the crisis which are well underway, and I won't start with that. I'm happy to address that if you'd like to turn to that at some point. But I think the most important thing in my mind is we hear people talk about when things return to normal. And I hope that the policymakers in both the Congress and the executive branch will use this as a moment to really question that idea of whether getting back to normal is the right thing, because there were some really significant underlying problems with normal, the normal that preceded the pandemic. And let me just touch on two. One is the thing I referred to earlier, which is opportunity inequality. People call this different things, and what they call it sometimes is indicative of how they think it should be addressed. But in my mind, opportunity inequality as opposed to income inequality or wealth inequality is the most important thing, because the thing that we're losing is the fluidity across socioeconomic classes, where the American dream used to be that you could grow up as a poor kid and have, you know, every possibility of ending in the top quartile. And that's increasingly unlikely. The fluidity across economic strata is much less than before. And addressing that will require real focus on the building blocks of opportunity in education and healthcare and things like that to give people their shot. It doesn't mean they get the opportunity handed to them, but they got to have their shot. And so that's one thing that I hope the president will be able to address and the Congress will be able to address. And it really starts with philosophically, what problem are you trying to solve? And then second, I think we've really lost some of the underlying focus we've had historically on maintaining technology leadership. If you look at our R&D spending today, is in comparison to 40 years ago, it's about half of what it was as a percentage of GDP. And I think we're going to need to really focus on innovation, innovation policy, R&D investing, the kinds of public-private sector partnership that will lead, that led to things like the space program and so forth. If we're going to be successful as in leading the world over the coming decades, and I think that's an area where we're going to need to make some substantive changes in policy and approach.
David, I'm very intrigued by this idea that going back to normal may not be so exciting and perhaps a bit fanciful. Is there a time that you can think of that was a normal we should want to return to?
Well, each era has its pros and cons. And of course, post-World War II, America really, post-World War II and then post-Cold War, it was a unilateral moment where America's leadership across, you know, pretty much every dimension, economically, militarily, technologically, was, you know, orders of magnitude larger than other countries around the world. That world's changed. And so the things that we could take for granted in the previous, 30 years no longer are the case. And so, as I said, there are pros and cons of every area. This era is going to require sort of going back to basics, as I like to say, going back to the gym and doing the things that we need to do as a country to make sure our building blocks of power, economic power, military power, are intact and that we're doing all we can. So our solutions for America's role in the world are much more in the things that we do as opposed to the things that others do. And I think having that focus. So I guess if I was going to sum up in one sentence, I think China has a plan for global leadership. I think many countries in the world have a plan. What's our plan? What's our plan to ensure continued global leadership across all the dimensions of power? I don't think that plan's very clear, and I think that should be the focus of our policymakers in the coming months and years.
It's probably fair to say, David, that the economy of the 2010s was defined largely by monetary stimulus, rising asset prices, and widening inequality. Now, of course, we have a pandemic. Should the Federal Reserve be juicing markets this aggressively, or is now the time to start putting the genie back in the bottle?
Well, it harkens back a little bit to my time in 2007 and 2008. It's very similar in some ways and different in other ways. But the bottom line is we're at a moment where we have the health crisis and the economic crisis, and we're really at the end of an era and in the midst of a paradigm shift where our ability to respond to the economic challenges we have with monetary policy alone is much more limited than it has been because of the enormity of what's already been done and the low interest rate environment we live in. And as a consequence, we think we're going to see much more of, MP3, which we refer to, which is the combination of fiscal and monetary. And unfortunately, at this moment, there's going to have to be a lot of policy intervention to get us through this patch. The consequences of not responding in a very forceful way are pretty dramatic. But like anything else, taking big steps like that in public policy have enormous second and third order questions, and we're going to have to deal with those. And so we're going to have to deal with the added indebtedness and the challenges that faces, and eventually we're going to have to begin to transition back to more normalcy in monetary policy. But I think that the time to do that is likely much more in the future than in the immediate.
David, you're not one of the investors at Bridgewater. That's up to Ray Dalio and Bob Prince and Greg Jensen principally, but you're a very astute observer of financial markets and a student of markets in the economy. There's a lot of talk these days about a bubble. Do you think we're in a bubble?
Well, I think we're at a moment of, enormous uncertainty where public policy is having more of an impact on markets than at, certainly at any time in my adult lifetime. And so that has a number of consequences to it. And what we're seeing is really a divergence of how the real economy and the markets are responding to what's happened. And eventually that divergence will have to be reconciled. But in the immediate term, because of the likelihood of continued policy response, I think we're going to see market behaviors that are very, are very broad ranging in terms of how things play out. And the reason for that is you've got the dynamics of the pandemic and the uncertainty around that. You have the dynamics and the uncertainty around the policy response. You have the uncertainty around our political situation and polarization that we see. And you have the uncertainty globally and geopolitically with US and China. And what that means is the range of possible outcomes for investors is extremely broad. You could have everything from a Japan-style recession, depression over the next decade, or a 1970s stagflation. And so if you're an investor or a policymaker, you need to be thinking about that broad continuum of possibilities. And so that creates a lot of uncertainty in markets and a lot of uncertainty for policymakers.
I will note that Japan-style recession or 1970s-style stagflation, neither of those is a continued bull market.
Well, both of them have hugely different impact on different asset classes. That's to be sure. But listen, you've got in what President Biden is proposing, and the current posture of the Fed, you have an enormous amount of policy response already done and policy response that's being contemplated, and that'll have very, very significant impacts, not only for markets, but hopefully for a real economy, and addressing, you know, the challenge, which is that the pandemic and the economic slowdown has really hurt the economy at large, but it's particularly been damaging for those people who are most vulnerable, for minorities, for women, business owners, for the people in the most challenged economic strata. And so we have to take meaningful and immediate action to address that economic challenge. And it also, of course, has consequences for our political stability and some of the division we have in our country. So it's one of those things where there's no easy answers, and all the responses have second and third order consequences. I, by and large, think that we're moving in the right direction, at least for now.
David, it took a decade or so for things to properly sort themselves out in the Bridgewater C-suite. Now that you're the sole CEO, tell us where the business of the firm is headed. Does Bridgewater need a shakeup?
Well, you know, I think if we're doing our job, we're always shaking ourselves up in the sense that we're always questioning and asking ourselves what we can do better. And if you look over Bridgewater's history, you know, you'll see a path where we've, you know, had consistent success over time, but there's been dips in performance, challenges the business has had. And we're at one of those moments where we sort of ask ourselves, okay, what can we do better to serve our clients going forward? And 2020 was a tough year in many ways for all of us, but it was also a great year in that it forced us to ask ourselves, what are the things we can do better? What parts of our investment machine are working? What can we do to improve on ourselves? What are we missing in markets? What does this new environment suggest? And so we're in the process of doing that, and I feel pretty great about it. I think the most important thing is that we serve our clients well in this period, and in a way that's consistent with how we operate with one another in our culture, which has been really critical to our success. And so what that means is the challenges I just described are what the biggest investors in the world are contemplating. How should they structure their portfolios in this moment? And so we try to serve their interests by having great return streams, great strategies that help them achieve their goals. But more than that, we hope to help them think more holistically about how they should be dealing with this environment. And that might mean how we help them structure their portfolio. It might mean helping them build out their capabilities. It's certainly been highly dependent on technology. And over the last year, we've really accelerated serving our clients with our technologies to help them think about their portfolios and so forth. So there's a number of things that are evolving in the way we try to serve our clients and to understand the markets. But if you look in Bridgewater's history, it's a moment consistent with many moments of the past. And my job is to make sure we continue that evolution and use this moment to learn and grow as much as we can.
David, you mentioned earlier that this is a time for America to think very seriously about its leadership position in the world. If people see Ray Dalio, Bridgewater's founder, as And I'm characterizing here, so let me be clear about that. People see him as sympathetic to China, and they make the assumption that that's because Bridgewater, one of Bridgewater's big clients, are Chinese state interests. The way you describe it, it sounds to me and has sounded to me in the past like you view China through a slightly more adversarial lens. Is that a fair way to describe things? People are interested in understanding, you know, the firm's perspective on what China represents, both as client and as sort of global player.
I think I'll make two comments on that. One is, understanding China and accessing China for global investors is sort of a critical question. With China being the size that it is and the impact on the economy, to be a global macro investor, you have to understand China deeply. You have to understand and potentially participate, if you're a global investor, in China's growth and so forth. So that's one bucket of questions. And certainly we spend a lot of time trying to understand that and help our clients understand it. And then there's a second question, which is China vis-a-vis the United States. And I guess the comment I would make on that is there's an evolution across political parties where the relationship between China is evolving, and China's rise and capabilities have led to an era where I think it's much more of a strategic competition than it was in the past. And there's bipartisan agreement on that. And that's going to require a different approach. There's lots of ways to collaborate with China, but there will be much more competition and many challenges, I think, in managing that relationship going forward.
David, one last one for you. Your best guess, a year from now, January 2022, where will we be with COVID?
Well, I'm really hopeful and optimistic that the combination of the vaccines, the behavioral shifts that we're learning, companies learning to adjust, will put us in a much more sustainable, normal posture. With that said, I think we're also entering an era where this type of thing may be, you know, more endemic. And by that, I mean, we may have to deal with variations of this going forward. This is something that may become a more integrated part of our lives and something that we just have to be able to adjust to. So I don't think there'll be a moment in, you know, the end of the year where we say we're done with this. I think there'll be a moment where we say this is a small part of our daily conversations, but something we've had to adjust to. And we're much more back to a world that's consistent with us being able to, you know, be together and collaborate together and so forth, which is something I certainly miss, and I suspect you do too.